Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Alex Butwinski and our first guest this morning, Antonio Garcia Martinez, who's the author of Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. After stints on Wall Street and CEO of his own startup, Martinez joined Facebook's nascent advertising team, turning its users' data into profit for COO Sheryl Sandberg and the chairman, CEO Mark Zuckerberg. Forced out in the wake of an internal product war over the future of the company's monetization strategy, Martinez eventually landed at rival Twitter. Chaos Monkeys lays bare the hijinks, trade secrets, power plays of the visionaries, grunts, sociopaths, opportunists, accidental tourists, and money cowboys who are revolutionizing our world. This conversation could go in many directions, so stay tuned for our adventure.
Good morning. I'm Alex Butwinski. Our second guest this morning is John Ruppel, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Utah. The federal government controls 31.2 million acres of land in Utah, and the state wants control of this land. But it's not that simple. A transfer would not eliminate requirements to comply with the Endangered Species Act, and a transfer would increase the amount of time and money needed to complete ESA permitting. Our next guest will help us understand why Utah wants these lands, the viability of the state's case for transfer, the cost for the potential upside, and for controlling these lands.
These two guests, plus today's cool stories. Yes, that's right, stories. A lot of good stories in science and tech for today. So when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Alex Butwinski. Our first guest this morning, Antonio Garcia Martinez. And he has written a fascinating book, Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. Antonio unravels the chaotic evolution of social media and online marketing and reveals how it is invading our lives and shaping our future. Weighing in at everything from startups and credit derivatives to Big Brother and data tracking, social media monetization, and digital privacy, Martinez shares his scathing observations and outrageous antics, taking us on a humorous, subversive tour of the fascinating insular technology industry. Antonio, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you. Looking forward to having you on the show because, you know, as Alex and I discussed back in the green room, you are a character. And I really appreciate not only the fact that you very accurately shine a light on what's going on in Silicon Valley, but you also shine a light on your own life and your own adventures in this sea of madness.
Yeah, I mean, the book is basically unfiltered truth of what it's like to go through the Silicon Valley roller coaster. And, you know, I could only really get away with putting a sort of critical eye on everyone around me if I put that same critical eye on myself, right? And so in some sense, I was as unsparing with myself as I was with, you know, everyone in the ecosystem that I described.
Yeah, I worked for three startup companies that eventually went public in Silicon Valley. I did it out of Boston because my family did not want to move there. But in those many years in that area, if you're a person that studies the human condition, there are a lot of characters. There's a lot of interesting things that happen out there, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, I think it's changing a little bit. I think Silicon Valley is getting a little bit more corporate, right? I mean, the people that normally would have gone to finance or consulting, I think, are ending up in Silicon Valley. But sure, definitely, it's absolutely the case that there's a bunch of sort of misfits and sort of dropouts and cowboys who you know, let's face it, really couldn't hold down a 9-to-5 regular corporate job and end up in Silicon Valley instead. And yeah, it's a rogues and sometimes heroes gallery of characters.
Yeah. And you hear these little vignettes of these stories that happen from time to time, but I had never heard anything about the lockdown at Facebook because of Google Plus. And that's an extraordinary story. Take a minute and tell us about it.
Yeah, so this was also excerpted in Vanity Fair. Basically, you know, when Google Plus, and by the way, in case your listeners don't remember, that was Google's attempt at social networking, right? And that was perceived inside Facebook. I think I make the illusion. It's kind of like the Soviets putting nukes on Cuba was to the United States in the 60s, right? This was the great enemy's foray into our hemisphere that we thought was ours. And so I think for the only time that I was at Facebook, I saw Facebook truly sort of fear for a moment, right? And so, you know, in the summer of 2011, Zuckerberg declared a lockdown. And what that means was, and that was sort of old Facebook lore, that meant back in the day when Facebook was facing some existential threat, either technical or external, you know, he'd almost literally lock the door and say, you can't leave until we solve this. And so he, you know, out of the blue, we get an email from Zuck saying, you know, show up around what was the aquarium, basically his sort of throne room. And he gave, you know, this sort of Roman general speech to the assembled engineers. And, you know, it was very rousing. And, you know, he even made allusions to sort of classical history, saying, you know, Carthage must be destroyed. You know, the famous Cato the Elder would say against the Carthaginians. And, you know, everyone just came out really roused. And for the next several months, basically, a lot of people worked 24/7, basically, for Facebook just to make it a better product faced with this threat. I mean, of course, the reality was that, you know, at the end of the day, as many readers have pointed out, you know, Google Plus dying was almost a suicide, right? Like, at the end of the day, it would have failed no matter what Facebook did. But still, I mean, the fact that the company could rally in such a way was really kind of exceptional, and I think it was sort of a unique look into the soul of Facebook.
Well, actually, since you mentioned Zuck first, you refer to him as a genius, and I think most people sort of have a public perception of who he is. But your take in the book was slightly different as to what his genius was.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's that movie, The Social Network, which is a work of almost pure fiction, in my experience about Facebook. Yeah, when I say a genius, I mean sort of the old school way of this sort of force of nature that just makes reality bend to its will around him and rallies, you know, an army of people willing to realize his vision, which is what Facebook is. You know, at Facebook, the engineers ran the show, and if you're a young engineer, you were given the keys to the kingdom from day one. When you join Facebook, you have two emails in your inbox. One says, you know, welcome to Facebook, et cetera. And the other is a list of bugs for you to fix in the software. And on your first day there, you download your own personal version of Facebook to your developer box, and you start making changes, and you're encouraged to actually make changes as soon as possible. And so that culture of shipping first and shipping always and empowering people to actually own part of this, you know, globe-spanning product, I think is the product of that Zuckerberg genius.
So actually, it seems to me that leads into or backs up to the whole story of AdGrok, where you guys basically developed it and sold it before you really had anything. Is there an analogy there, or is that slightly different?
Oh God, no! I wouldn't. I have trouble even mentioning my name in the same sentence with Zuckerberg. No, I mean, I think what AdGrok, I think why I mentioned it, at the end of the day, it was a nothing company, right? I mean, in the scheme of things, but why I think I mentioned it because it actually is completely emblematic of the boom right now. You know, we were three guys. We applied into this prestigious accelerator called Y Combinator. We had every problem that could possibly happen to a startup happen. Co-founder issues. We couldn't raise money. Then we could raise money. Then we got sued. We launched. And, you know, we had actually a decent number of users, but a lot of them weren't converting to paid users because they were small businesses. You know, every problem in the book. And then out of nowhere, for random reasons, because they used to like to read my blog, the Twitter, you know, corporate development team, the company, you know, the part of the company that buys companies, it came out and bought us after 10 months, right? Even though the company was effectively failing. But, you know, that's what's called these days, it's called an acqui-hire. And what that means is sort of partly hiring engineers and partly an acquisition, but it's really more hire than it is acqui, in the sense that, believe it or not, it's so hard to find qualified engineers in Silicon Valley. Companies buy other companies effectively as a recruitment tool, effectively. And that's what AdGrok really was at the end of the day. I mean, all it really was a year-long job interview for a job at Twitter or Facebook. That's all it was. It wasn't a company. And so that's one of the truths that often goes unsaid in Silicon Valley.
And how often is the technology jettisoned as their interest is just in the people?
Every time. every single time, almost every single time. I mean, it's rare. I mean, if the company's actually being bought for a product or a business or for revenue, then, I mean, the product might be killed accidentally because the big company sort of incompetently bungles it. But in the case of an acquihire like AgRock, they don't even try to maintain the technology. It's literally just gone. And everyone just understands that. That's the way it is.
Yeah, I learned a valuable lesson years and years ago, and you've learned the same lesson, obviously. You were talking about, and I may have the companies wrong, but I think you were considering going to Facebook or to Twitter. And one of the things that you looked at was that when you go to Facebook, the parking lot is absolutely jam-packed at 8 o'clock at night with engineers' cars. And when you go to Twitter, not so much. And I remember interviewing a Sun Microsystems years ago, and I was with one of the venture capitalists. This is when I think they had less than 50 employees, maybe less than 40 employees. And he said, now, come on out and take a look at this parking lot. And it was a small parking lot, and Sun, of course, was really small at the time. But every engineer was there, and it was about 10 o'clock at night. And that's a good lesson. You don't want to join a startup where everybody is kind of counting their chickens before they roost.
Right. There's a scene in there. So the parking lot thing, I drew that parallel with Google, actually, because Google is getting big enough such that I think people don't really work that hard anymore.
It was Google.
But you're right that I drew a similar parallel with Twitter. What happened with AgRock is we basically got competing offers, at least for me, from Facebook and Twitter. And we went through the full interview process with both as if we were being hired. And somebody, obviously I don't mention his name because I still know the guy, but in the Twitter interview said, well, you know, at Facebook and Google, they give you breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But at Twitter, and by the way, this is true at the time. It's not true anymore. But at Twitter, you know, we only get breakfast and lunch, wink, wink, implying that, you know, you weren't expected to be there late into the evening if you had sort of an outside loss. And, you know, the moment he said, I think he was trying to sell me. And, of course, you know, that actually just sealed the deal. And I realized there's no way that I'm going to sell this one ticket I have into the big leagues and go to Twitter instead of Facebook. And so, yeah, I mean, I came to the exact same conclusion in my experience, basically.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Antonio Martinez, who's written really a cool book. I mean, this is a book that moves pretty quick and a lot of anecdotal stories about what's going on in Silicon Valley as Antonio maneuvered through the sea of madness through various jobs. Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. Let's talk about technology for a second, and let me just tell you a quick story. I go to Mexico every year to play golf with these people, and I've been there 5 times, and I met this guy from Houston, and he and I became friends. We only see each other once a year when we are in Mexico at this golf tournament. And this winter, he decided to come out and ski in Park City, where we are out here. And so he comes over having a little party, and he arrives at the airport and shuttles up and walks into my house and puts out his hand. I put out my hand. We shake hands just as we're shaking hands. It's the first time we've seen each other in the United States. Again, we've only seen each other in Mexico. Both of our phones light up, and we have received questions from Facebook, or was it LinkedIn? I think it was LinkedIn. Do you know each other? And so it was sort of unnerving and really unsettling that the proximity software was so sophisticated that as soon as we got within, you know, touch of each other, this thing lit up. And so the question that I have, because you're on the ad side and you've written some pretty sophisticated software for tracking people and their habits, what else do these companies know about us? And what technology is out there that is tracking us that maybe we have not heard of?
Yeah, that's one of the points I go into, because my first job, my job title at Facebook was the product manager for ads targeting. So basically turning your data into tools that advertisers can use and then into money. And so, yeah, I mean, I obsessed about turning data into money. You know, I think one of the points I make, and I might come off as slightly a Facebook fanboy, is that, you know, a lot of the, you know, everyone has their sort of favorite almost conspiracy theory story about some weird thing they did on Facebook and then they saw an ad, right? You know, it's almost like the, you know, it only rains when you wash the car type thing, in which they have this confirmation bias of, oh, look, I saw this ad. In fact, I tell a story in there once that it was my first time dealing with it, that I got in the inbound from like the PR team that some LA Times reporter had noticed that, you know, her brother's sister's cousin, psychologist or something, you know, posted a photo of a 49ers jersey and then she was seeing 49ers ads. Was it possible? that we were using sophisticated image recognition software and somehow linked it through the social chain to her and therefore showed her an ad. Of course, the answer is no, because at least at the time, the targeting system was very crude, and you know, doing image recognition at the scale of billions of photos a day to that level of detail is something that even Facebook can't pull off. You know, the real answer was far more pedestrian. Basically, there was a game that weekend, and the 49ers were running a very broadly targeted ad campaign to everyone in San Francisco over the weekend, and that's why she saw the ad. And so, I mean, in your case, it sounds like maybe there was something similar to like what's called Facebook Nearby. When there's like a friend nearby, it actually pings you and says, hey, so-and-so is nearby. So maybe there actually, you know, something did go on. But I think one of the lessons I think I want people to take away from Chaos Monkeys is that, and this is the best way to put it, basically, you know, just because you have, say, you know, a photo on the internet of you that's embarrassing, or say for example, just because you have a nude photo of you on the internet, doesn't mean anyone's actually willing to pay money for it, right? And what I mean by that is that often a lot of your private data, your communications with your partner or your family, et cetera, while obviously it's very personal to you, doesn't actually have a lot of commercial value. Like, there's no way to monetize that. I mean, even if you assume perfectly evil behavior on behalf of Facebook, what would they do with that, right? And so, I mean, that's what we learned very quickly when we tried using a lot of this data, that a lot of it actually isn't very worthwhile. I mean, you asked the question of what are you giving up that you don't know? Well, I mean, here's something that you're probably giving Facebook you don't realize. I mean, the real goldmine, I think, that Facebook has data-wise is the fact that it knows who you are on every device that you touch, right? So it knows your work computer where you're, you know, idly browsing for whatever over lunch. It knows your home computer where you actually make the sale. And it knows, you know, your mobile phone that you're scrolling through when, you know, you're stuck in a commute or whatever, right? And joining all those experiences, the media that you've seen and then your behavior on there, if you buy anything, that's actually really valuable when it comes to sort of like nerdy level of ad tech of like, oh, you know, what's called attribution. Like, you know, you saw a piece of media and then you did a thing. Tying that all together is actually really difficult to do. And no one can really do it as well as Facebook can, given their data. And so, I mean, that's one of the real learnings. I mean, you know, part of the reason you're probably going to get into some more of the technology. You know, the technology I built was exactly that technology that when you go browse the internet and then you go to Facebook and you see those same products, like I built that, right? And the reason that we needed to build that is because a lot of the data inside Facebook actually isn't very useful. Again, it doesn't have, here's what Facebook would like to know, but doesn't know. What's sitting unbought in your Amazon shopping cart, right? What did you look on the shelves at Best Buy? What car do you drive? How old is it? And do you need a replacement, right? Things like that is what Facebook actually doesn't have. And so, you know, the reality is Facebook doesn't really sell your data. It buys your data by providing tools to advertisers such that they want to give Facebook that sort of valuable data. And so I think that's the real lesson that, you know, a lot of the data that you should really be fearful of. If you want to be paranoid, you should be fearful of the advertiser that's trying to get you and will try to sell you a sweater or a car at any cost. Well, at the end of the day, Facebook really wants you to just keep on using the app and as like a very sideline thing tries to make money off you. But that's really what the priorities are internally at Facebook.
So that monetization idea leads to a question I've always had, and it's I think you actually do a really good description of it. So maybe that would be helpful for listeners. How does Google actually generate revenue? In other words, you know, through their searches,
right,
there's a whole table and how they do that.
Right. I mean, it's funny because, you know, Google gets a lot of play out of the fact that it funds, you know, self-driving cars and Wi-Fi balloons and maps and a free Gmail, so, like all this stuff. The reality is all of that gets paid for, like 98% of Google's revenue is those little, you know, those little crappy text ads you see on top or to the right of a Google search when you perform a Google search. And you may not, some people don't even realize those are actually paid. I mean, they're set off, you know, Google kind of skates on some thin ice there and makes it seem like a search result, although I think they're highlighted in yellow now. And that's where all the money comes from. And like literally, you know, the metaphor to think about it is, you know how a restaurant chain or a car dealership might have one or two outlets that are most profitable ones, or maybe like Ford will have one model car that makes its quarter? Well, the equivalent for Google is literally words. People bid on words like loan, insurance, college loan, online nursing degree. These are the sort of online, what are called lead generation businesses, that people pay, you know, $40, $50, even $100 a click to get you to click on that little text ad. And it literally is an auction in human language in which you go and enter keywords and people actually bid on them. And Google doesn't even try to really estimate much about human language or try to understand what you're saying. It literally just holds an auction for every snippet of human language. And that happens billions of times a day. And, you know, that's how Google makes, you know, over $50 billion a year.
I guess the part that I didn't understand was the real-time bidding. I mean, if the attorney example you used was really interesting, and it's like it seems like your per-click charge changes, like, constantly.
Yes, right. So yeah, there's a couple of things here. So in the case of Google and I mentioned mesothelioma, which is a rare form of cancer, and there's all these class action suits around it because asbestos workers in the 70s and 80s are basically getting it now. And so lawyers, if you want to go and steal some money from a lawyer or whatever, make them spend money, enter mesothelioma and then just start clicking on the ads and you're costing a lawyer almost $100 every time you do that.
I love that anecdote in there.
Yeah. Well, the joke is like if there's a company you don't like, Google them and then make sure to click to them through the ad rather than through an organic lead because then you make Comcast pay to get your traffic or whatever. I mean, that's kind of like the negative marketer's sort of joke. But and you mentioned the other thing, which is the real-time bidding, which is a little bit separate, although I think it's also interesting, which is whether you realize it or not, every time you go to Facebook or every time you go to the internet, there's an auction being held at your attention. And every page load, there's signals that go out to hundreds of advertisers who then go, and it's all anonymous, of course, but Facebook or Google basically says, this person is here, what do you know about them, how much you want to pay, and what ads do you want to show them? And that those advertisers then go to the databases and look up everything you've bought, everything you've, shared or browsed or whatever, come up with a piece of ad creative and a bid, and submit that. And that happens literally hundreds of billions of times a day. It's the same way that, millions of shares of Google get traded on the New York Stock Exchange, billions of eyeballs get traded on the world's ad exchanges as we speak. And, that's part of what I built at Facebook with what's called FBX, which is a Facebook exchange. That's the reality of media today. It literally is like, Michael Lewis's book Flash Boys, if you read it. It's high-frequency trading in human attention.
So we've created all of these new currencies. We have eyeball currency. We have likes. We have positive reviews or negative views. I mean, you can build a company just on your reviews, and that's why there's so much rhetoric out there with companies that come up and provide services to write false reviews. Can we talk about currencies?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a real question, because early on in the book, I sort of described like a case study of like Facebook failure, right? Which is, I mean, it's ancient history now, but it's interesting to the students of social media or business that, it had this whole business, if I'm sure your listeners remember back in the day, Facebook used to have what are all these stories, like particularly Spotify, right? Like so-and-so is listening to whatever, right? Like everything somebody did or went for a run, right? And these kind of polluted your feed for a while. And this was this product thing called Open Graph, which was like Facebook's big bet to sort of ingest everything you're doing in the world, right? And be the sort of language for expressing what you're doing online. And then there was a monetization side of it in which people would sort of pay to have those stories appear in your feed effectively, kind of like you do Google search results, right? And it was this, and they were trying to sell effectively the fact that you had liked something, right? And it was this massive failure for various reasons. For starters, right? I mean, you mentioned currencies, and you're right, like there are various currencies, right? But the thing is that at some point, whether it be Bitcoin or whether it be the Thai baht, right? It needs to translate into a hard currency of some sort, right?
Right.
You can only float this on like dreams of vaporware for so long. At some point, you need to buy a cup of coffee or pay your rent, right? At the end of the day, every company has to do that, right? And so, and that was the problem with Facebook, right? That it would produce these likes, for example, like for years. In addition to the sponsored story thing, companies like Starbucks or BMW would pay tens of millions of dollars a year to accumulate likes for their page. And they wouldn't really know why they're doing it. They were just told by, the 30-year-old guy running their social media campaign, you should buy likes, right? And then at the end of the day, they have to wonder, okay, so we got 5 million likes, now what? And, the only thing they was actually good for, same thing with the Open Graph stuff, was that they could spam your feed. At the time, that was the only way to get a piece of commercial content into your feed, right? Ads were only on the right-hand side. But then, that lived at the mercy of Facebook. And if they wanted to drive, more personal sharing instead of commercial content, they would just kick you out of the feed, which they do all the time. And so it was this horrible trade in which, no one could really tell what these likes were worth. And so I think that's the lesson to be learned. At the end of the day, the funny money needs to turn into real money. And even Facebook can't get people to believe that their funny money is real at some point.
You described a scene, I think it was your first day at Facebook, and they had a bunch of new hires from other organizations as well, and you were all sitting together as a group, and some slick PR guy comes up and says, okay, what's Facebook? And someone says, well, it's social media, and he says, no, it's not. It's, I forget what you said, personal, unique newspaper that's delivered every day to many millions of people. What does Facebook really think that they are?
No, I think that's true. The guy who was saying that actually wasn't, I mean, he was doing PR, certainly, but his role wasn't PR at Facebook. He was actually the head of product. He is like the guiding visionary leader, other than Zuckerberg, at Facebook of the product.
Okay.
And so, yeah, Facebook brought out its big guns for the onboarding. They didn't skimp on the speakers when it came to the onboarding. It was like a lineup of the high and mighty at Facebook at the time. So, yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, it's straight out of the horse's mouth there. You know, Cox saying, I forget how he phrased it, too. I think it was the newspaper review or the New York Times review, Channel U, right? This personalized social newspaper of what you should be caring about today. They really think about it that way. I mean, that's really true. And I get at this elsewhere in the book, and I think this is part of Zuckerberg's genius. You know, when people at Facebook say things like, we want to create a more open and connected world, you know, we might think, oh, what frilly stuff, right? But they actually believe that. Like and as did I, by the way, when I was there. Like they really do think that is the goal of Facebook. And, you know, and they are, in a way, they are succeeding. I mean, if you looked at something like, I don't know, just a random thing like the coup in Turkey, for example, I was following the Facebook Live video updates from the coup as it was happening, and that was better than news, right? Correspondents weren't at the bridge being blocked by soldiers, but there was 10 people there transmitting live on Facebook, watching the tanks get overwhelmed, right? And so they have created the newspaper review in many ways. And that's what they really believe. They really think it is your form of identity online, like full stop on every app ever, that the Facebook you is the real you, and then it's the way to communicate going forward. That's really how they think about it.
Well, one of the things, just to switch gears completely, was when the three of you got into AdGrok together, one of the things you talk about is the most important thing of what do you get in a partnership. Are you still there, Antonio? I think we might have lost him.
Antonio, are you there? Oh, it looks like we lost him, but, you know, we're okay.
Yes, we did.
Well, we lost him, but I tell you what. It was a good conversation, and we were just buttoning up. I think we had a couple of questions left, and we were just going to say goodbye to him. But again, Antonio Garcia Martinez, who has written Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. He worked for a number of companies out there, and in the ad space side, very interesting. He also worked for Goldman Sachs in New York City. So, interesting guy.
Career. Fascinating book, as John and I said earlier. It's definitely a hard to put down read, which I haven't had one of those in a really long time.
When we return, we're going to have a conversation with John Ruppel. He's the associate professor of law, University of Utah, and we're going to be talking about the 31.2 million acres of federally controlled land and the prospects and challenges of a transfer to the state of Utah. Stay with us.
This is Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and KPCW supporter. Epic Promise grants focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our communities. Grants fund programs that help kids achieve great things in the classroom and develop a passion for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, KPCW supporter, providing personalized knee and shoulder care, focusing on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing, and now incorporating stem cell therapy. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We were just speaking with Antonio Garcia Martinez, author of Chaos Monkeys, Obscene Fortune, and Random Failure in Silicon Valley. Our next guest is John Ruppel, Associate Professor of Law, University of Utah. And as we said, the federal government controls 31.2 million acres of land in Utah, and the state wants control of this land. But it's not quite that simple. A transfer would not eliminate requirements to comply with the Endangered Species Act, and a transfer would increase the amount of time and money needed to complete ESA permitting. John will help us understand why Utah wants these lands, the viability of the state's case for transfer, the cost and the potential upside for controlling these lands. John Ruppel, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. In terms of why the state is targeting these lands, as you say, the state's looking to obtain title to 31.2 million acres of federally owned public lands in the state. That's via the Transfer of Public Lands Act. The state has demanded title to those lands, and if the federal government chooses not to turn those over, the state is threatening to pursue litigation to obtain that. I think the driver behind that is an expectation that if the state controlled those lands, it would have more control over the manner in which they're managed, that there's an assumption that the state would be a more better, efficient manager, and I think in the minds of many that means that they would be able to expedite development and be able to increase revenue production from those lands. So the driver behind this, I think, is an expectation that it would be a net economic benefit for the state.
I still, I guess, don't understand why the state feels like that land belongs to us. As a layman or as a citizen casually listening to it, it goes back to, I guess, when we became a state, there was an agreement or part of the deal was that the land would remain federal. Am I correct on that, or is that where the genesis of this was?
There are a couple of arguments that the state is making as to its claims to the public lands. And I think, first of all, as you point out, I think there's kind of a public policy argument that somehow these lands need to be returned to Utah as if they were ours in the first place. And that's a mistaken argument. When we look at the lands in question, they never belonged to the state of Utah. Going back historically, these are lands that were first inhabited by Native Americans. They had held Aboriginal title until the Spaniards came to North America and obtained title through conquest. Mexico succeeded Spain in title when Mexico won its independence from Spain. And then following the Mexican-American War, those lands were transferred from Mexico to the United States via the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And as you may be aware, the Constitution of the United States reserved the power to make international treaties exclusively to the federal government, and that war was essentially paid for with federal funds. Anyway, when the lands in question, including all of Utah, were acquired via the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, they became federal land. Subsequently, Congress set up the Utah Territory and later passed legislation, the Utah Enabling Act, that set forth conditions under which Utah could move from territorial status to statehood. And when that occurred, the federal government granted to the state of Utah about 7.5 million acres of land. Now, the lands that are being targeted under the Transfer Public Lands Act are lands above and beyond the 7.5 million acres that the federal government already gave to the state of Utah. So in terms of taking it back, that I think that argument is a bit of a fallacy. Now, why does Utah think they are entitled to these lands? Well, if you look at the Utah Enabling Act, it has a provision in there that disclaims the state's claims of title to the land. It says in two different places, you know, one provision says that Utah shall forever disclaim all right and title to unappropriated public lands. In the minds of some, now I should say that provision goes on to talk about extinguishing title, and in the minds of some, that provision has been interpreted to imply that the federal government needs to continue to extinguish federal land ownership, and that means giving that land to the state. That argument just doesn't really hold up factually. And I should point out that we have this disclaimer clause not just in federal legislation, but it was adopted and incorporated into the Utah Constitution. There's also a provision in the Utah Enabling Act that says that Utah shall not be entitled to any further or other grants of public land beyond the 7.5 million acres that we were guaranteed at statehood. So we have those provisions that really stand in the way of Utah's claims. And one of the ways, again, that Utah tries to get around that is by claiming something called the Equal Footing Doctrine applies. And basically, the Equal Footing Doctrine says that when a new state is admitted to the Union, that state assumes all the rights and privileges of other states. So in the minds of transfer backers, the fact that Western states have significant federal land holdings puts them at a disadvantage because federal lands are not subject to state or local property taxes. So the consequence of that, again, in the minds of some, is that the federal government needs to dispose of these lands in order to put Utah on an equal footing with its eastern peers. The challenge with that argument, though, is that the Supreme Court has been very clear over the years that the equal footing doctrine does not apply to dry land. It does not require the federal government to dispose of dry land, and it is not intended to create a quality of condition among states. What it did do is create a quality of political rights and opportunity. So to go back to that question of territorial status, when Utah was a territory, the federal government appointed our territorial governor, our territorial judges, our territorial marshal. We were able to send a delegate to Congress to speak at the House of Representatives, but that individual was not able to vote, and we had no representation in the Senate. So when we became a state, all of those things changed. We obviously became able to elect our own governor, our own congressional delegation, and we inherited those same political rights as our peers, but we didn't necessarily gain the right to title to land beyond what was already promised in the Enabling Act.
Mm. Hey,
so that's a bit of a long-winded response there. Sorry about that.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with John Ruppel, Associate Professor of Law, University of Utah. We're talking about the 31.2 million acres of federally controlled land in Utah that Utah would like to control themselves. How strong is Utah's case? Short answer, please.
Short answer, we don't think it's a very strong case at all. We think it's legally suspect, and the likelihood of success is very, very low. And I'd go beyond that to say that even if we're mistaken, that path forward will be very, very long. It will take decades, and it will cost millions of dollars because there will be a lot of site-specific litigation that will need to occur.
And we've already spent, I think, $14 million on this one piece of litigation in trying to get things to work. There are detractors that say that there's a lot more money that would have to be spent to be able to make this happen. I'm curious, Utah is not the only state to have BLM, Bureau of Land Management, controlled territories. Other states that have taken over territories, if there is precedence for that, have they had costs that were not expected?
Well, thus far, Utah is at the forefront of the movement to transfer public lands, from the federal government to the states. So we don't have a good analog. We can't look at it and say, within recent history, here are the costs that are involved with a transfer, because, again, Utah is in the vanguard for that movement. But what we can do is look at the kinds of costs that are incurred in managing federal lands, whether there's a significant change when you move from federal to state management, and those kinds of questions. And when we see that, when we try to do that, I think what we see is that it's less about the manager than it is about the mandate. It's the mandate under which we manage those lands that really affects the cost of management as well as the ability to generate revenue from them.
One of the things that we find interesting is how the Endangered Species Act fits into this, and transferring it would increase the time and money to complete ESA permitting. Why would that be? Is that because Utah would be able to be obstructionist, or what exactly is that scenario?
It's a great question, and I think the first thing to understand is the Endangered Species Act applies not just to federal land, it applies to all land. There's some minor differences in how we deal with plants versus animals, but basically the Endangered Species Act encourages us to prevent the extinction of imperiled species and to take those species that are on the brink of extinction and pull them back. So we prohibit activities that would harm those species or harm their habitat, whether they're on federal land or state land or private land for that matter. So the prohibitions are the same, but the process that one goes through in order to protect themselves from liability for inadvertently harming a species, those change quite dramatically, and I think that's important to understand. you know, the hammer behind the Endangered Species Act is a potential fine of up to $50,000 per violation, as well as up to a year in jail for each time we violate that act. And as I say, we avoid liability by going through a certain procedural steps. Those steps change depending on whether we have federal land or a federal permit involved or not. And essentially what we found when we started looking at this question is that it can take 2 to 3 times as long to get comparable protections when you lack that federal nexus. And I think that's in part because Congress has tried to expedite that process when federal lands are involved by mandating that some of those processes run concurrently. And because the federal agencies are far more experienced in working through that process. So if we lose that federal nexus, it has the potential to slow future development on what was formerly public land. And it also calls into question what we technically called incidental take statements under the Endangered Species Act that have previously been granted, because those are no longer enforceable because we no longer have that federal nexus and the federal agency can't guarantee those processes.
So what's the real upside for Utah? I mean, obviously it's been in the news a lot lately, and one can piece together what those things are, but what do you think the real upside is, and why do we want it?
You know, as you said at the outset, roughly 2/3 of the land within the state of Utah is federally controlled and federally managed, and that has a significant impact on Utah residents. It affects our economy, it affects our way of life, it affects our culture. So these lands are really important to us, you know, economically and to our sense of identity. So it's natural that we care about these lands. And I think there is understandably some frustration about the way public lands are managed. Our land managers have a very difficult job. They're charged with balancing a wide range of competing uses, and it's a difficult challenge, especially when they're not fully funded to do those things. Unfortunately, I think there's a disconnect here between the frustration that many experience about, you know, what they perceive as a lack of voice in those decisions, or decisions that may not necessarily reflect individual objectives, and the path forward represented by the Transfer of Public Lands Act. It's just there's a disconnect there. That, you know, we believe there's a better way to get at those underlying frustrations than demanding the federal government turn over title to these lands.
Is some of this emotional, John? Like if you think about Brexit over in the UK, a lot of folks wanted to be independent. They emotionally felt they should be in charge of their own destiny. And it may or may not, I mean, we'll find out in years to come if it was in the best interest or not for them to leave the European Union. Is there something similar going on here where emotion is driving a lot of our desire to make this happen?
I think you're on to something there. You know, as I said, people care very deeply about public lands here in Utah and across the West. These are lands that are critical to our sense of identity. They're lands that we recreate upon. They're lands that many folks make their livelihood upon. So there's a very strong sense of attachment. Sometimes there is a sense of frustration when those lands are managed in ways that we may not individually agree with, when that balance of multiple use of trying to reconcile commodity development versus wilderness protection versus watershed protection versus recreation and so forth doesn't play out in the ways we want, that builds frustration. And I think people get quite upset in some cases, and maybe with respect to the Transfer of Public Lands Act, we're seeing a very vocal minority that is overwhelming the sense of the majority that seems to be much more satisfied with the existence of public lands.
Right. Our general manager, Larry Warren, knows a tremendous amount about Bears Ears National Monument, or the potential for the National Monument. We were talking with him this morning, and it's just a fascinating piece of history going back and sort of the long view that the government holds in trying to preserve some of these territories and all of that. How does that play in to all of this? It is maybe 1.5 million of the 31.2 million acres. Do you believe it's going to be made a national monument? How does this play into the land grab or whatever you would call it?
Well, I think the Bears Ears and the Cedar Mesa area is an amazing area. As you're aware, that the coalition of tribes, the five tribes that are backed by 24 additional tribes, they're proposing a 1.9 million acre national monument. Congressman Bishop's Public Lands Initiative, that proposes to create two national conservation areas in that general area that would cover about 1.25 million acres of land. So there are efforts to protect that region, and those lands are some of the lands that are targeted via the Transfer of Public Lands Act. So in some ways, efforts like the Public Lands Initiative are a counter to the Transfer of Public Lands movement. We'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But it's certainly a critically important area, and I think it does highlight the tensions that are involved in balancing those competing multiple uses of our federal public lands. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. It does. Thank you.
Well, it does kind of go into Congressman Bishop's Public Land Initiative. It's obviously very, very topical around here. This whole idea of what's going on has been an incredible saga. What do you think the outcome is likely to be?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, but I'm not terribly optimistic about the fate of the Public Lands Initiative. It's very ambitious legislation. I think there's some significant challenges in the bill that have not been ironed out. There's significant opposition to that bill. So the likelihood of being able to get a bill through both houses of Congress and then signed into law by the president before he leaves office, that strikes me as very low. It seems like there's significant work left to be done on the bill. So if that's the case, the question seems to become whether the president would be willing to designate a national monument before he leaves office. And I think the case for doing that is very, very strong. This is a really important landscape in terms of, you know, the archaeological, the cultural, historic resources, some of the environmental resources. It really is a national treasure. The National Trust for Historic Preservation has said there are upwards of 100,000 discrete archaeological sites in that area. So I think the case for preservation is very, very strong. You know, what that will look like in the end, I think, remains to be seen. But I would be surprised if we don't see some protection. And again, I'm gazing into that crystal ball that I tried to avoid, but my suspicion is it's more likely to come via National Monument Proclamation than the Public Lands Initiative.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. It's like watching a reality show that we will get to watch the back and forth as we go forward. John, thanks for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio. It's been a pleasure. And when we return, we will have today's cool story in science.
Yeah, John, because we wanted to talk about some science and technology. We couldn't understand the angle, but we definitely wanted to talk to you because it's such a fascinating topic. Is there any science or technology angle to this discussion this morning?
You know, I'm not going to try and force one. I think the discussion so far is more about policy.
Yeah,
it
is.
Certainly there are questions about the kinds of technologies that would be used if we're to develop these lands, but I think that's a bit of a stretch. So let's leave it as a policy discussion for now, and thank you very much for your time and interest.
John Ruppel, Associate Professor of Law, University of Utah. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. When we return, after a couple of messages, we're going to be talking about, we're going to be talking about some cool stories, so stay with us. Today's cool stories.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. the museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Angela from Peak Art and Frame, sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Peak Art and Frame offers local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio, KPCW in Park City. And we have a few minutes before we button up the program, and we thought, well, we'd just talk about some of these cool stories. As you know, we have eight planets. The planets are Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And man, I was hoping we had a ninth. I was hoping that, you know, poor Pluto could be our planet, but it didn't pass muster. It didn't.
No, I think, John, you have some very personal feelings about this.
I do. I like Pluto. I do like Pluto.
Wax poetic in the green room. What does it take to be a planet?
Well, it takes basically three things. You have to be in orbit around the sun, and Pluto is, but so are thousands of other asteroids. Secondarily, you have to have sufficient mass to assume, and this is a big word, hydrostatic equilibrium. And that's just a real fancy way of saying that it's spherical in shape, that it is round. Pluto does, whereas many of the asteroids and other minor planets are really weirdly shaped. So Pluto's got two out of the three, but they get hammered on the third. And this is the big one. They have to clear what they call clear the neighborhood around its orbit, and the gist of it is it has to be gravitationally dominant in its orbit. And Pluto, this is where Pluto fails. Pluto's with a whole bunch of other things in the Kuiper belt as objects that fly together, and even Pluto is part of the outside of Neptune's orbit. So basically, that's why it got nailed.
Too bad for Pluto, I guess.
Yeah, and there's so much cool information on Pluto coming out, too, and beautiful, beautiful pictures. We know so much more about it just in the last year with that probe that we sent out there.
Well, as you mentioned, we have eight planets. You know, Mercury is 36 million miles from the sun. Obviously, the Earth is at 93. I skipped Venus at 67, Mars 141. So, you know, we pretty well have it nailed down. We got poor Pluto out there trying to decide whether it's a planet or not. But wait, there's more. And John brought an interesting study this morning, which I always continue to marvel at how we find this stuff out. But John, what was that?
Well, this was reported about a year ago, and I've been continuing to Google it to see if there's any new information on it. And it showed up in the New York Times science section this week. But basically, there are half a dozen of small bodies in these elliptical orbits, which are way out in the solar system, where Pluto is the furthest, 4.6 billion miles away. This is like somewhere between 20 and 100 billion miles away. I mean, this is so far out, but there are these six bodies that are in elliptical orbit, so they believe that suggests that there is a planet out there. And so anyway, there's going to be some more information on that, and it's pretty cool.
I know, but the whole idea of measuring magnet force or gravity pull at that distance is just...
Oh, yeah.
Astounding. Just amazing.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Hey, we're going to take just a short break. We shall be back right after this final message. Stay with us. Cool Science Radio.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And we're back. We'd like to thank our sponsors, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, and Picart and Frame, Davidson Orthopedics, Nexus IT, and the Natural History Museum of Utah and Park City.
Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us, NPR.